Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-.
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
Back alongside his soulmate, Dwight York, in the Manchester United attack this evening. They played brilliantly here for Manchester United against Barcelona.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to the Football Rambles Guide 2. I'm Marcus Speller.
I'm Luke Moore.
And I'm Vidushin Hantaraja.
The defining period of Sir Alex Ferguson's 27-year reign as Manchester United manager may actually only have lasted for about 3 minutes.
It's come for Dwight York.
That's how long it took Teddy Sheringham and Ole Gunnar Solskjaer to turn certain defeat into immortal victory in the 1999 Champions League final over Bayern Munich in Ferguson's personal realm, added time. Success at the Nou Camp completed a treble of Premier League, FA Cup and Champions League victories that is still yet to be repeated and cemented Ferguson's place among the greats. It may have been a dramatic smash and grab, but it was years in the making and featured meticulous planning, clever adaptation and exceptional management from Ferguson.
Nobody will ever win a European Cup final more dramatically than this.
We're going to look back on what Clive Tyldesley would repeatedly call that magical night in Barcelona, featuring David Beckham in central midfield.
And what we believe is his preferred role, the heart of the midfield.
Ryan Giggs on the wrong flank, and David May. It's the Football Rambles Guide to the 1999 Champions League final.
Manchester United are the champions of Europe again.
Gentlemen, this Friday will mark 10 years since Sir Alex Ferguson's last game in charge of Manchester United. That 5-5 draw with West Bromwich Albion on the 19th of May 2013. But we thought we would mark the occasion talking about a different game. The 1999 Champions League
final. A better one. Possibly not a better game, but a more important game.
A more important game.
Yeah.
A more important game. Do you remember where you were, what you did, etc., etc., after Manchester United won this game, Vish?
So I was 13. I was very excited and I went to bed. It was kind of, thing where, you know, the more I think back on it, I'm like...
Did you have a little Man United shirt on?
I did, yeah.
Thankful it didn't go to extra time because at that age, you know...
Yeah, I'd be livid if my dad sent me to bed at that point. But in hindsight, it was one of those moments where I think, good God, how much would I cry? So I should go a bit mad right now if I witnessed something like that, you know, to see a team you love go and, well, just pull something out of the bag like that. And
it just feels like, because truthfully, they're quite bad now, aren't they, Man United?
Yeah, that's part of it. Yeah. Don't keep bringing that up. Yeah. I did the David Moyes guy too the other week. This is my dessert.
Your redemption.
Yeah. But yeah, no, went straight to bed and was incredibly excited, thinking this is a lot of fun.
Mm. What, what usually used to happen when you went to bed really excited when you're 30?
Yeah, all right, that'll do. Luke, what about you?
I was 18.
Oh, yeah.
So a touch older.
In the pub, weren't you?
I wasn't with Vish. Yeah. That absolutely clear. Mm-hmm. And I wasn't the
get him to bed.
I watched it at home because I was very earnest about football then, and I took it very seriously. And I wouldn't
then,
and even now I don't really like watching big games in the pub.
No,
I just don't really think you can watch them properly. I'm someone who, for all my many faults, I'm genuinely a football fan, not just someone who thinks, oh, football's cool, so I'll like it. And that's what the pub's full of, it seems to be, in those big occasions.
How have you used that question to have a go at so many different people?
I was about to say, like,
it's a skill that's been honed over several years.
Right.
So I watched it at home, on my own, on the telly.
Okay. Well, I'm sure everyone down the pub is glad.
They were delighted.
Oh, misery got us mores at home. Thank goodness for that.
A lot of Bayern Munich fans in my local pub were like, well, it could be worse. At least Luke's not here.
Yeah, true enough. Yeah.
How about you, Mark?
I watched it at home, and I can remember when the first goal was in, when the second one went in, I just didn't know what to do with myself. It was mayhem.
Even though you had no skin in the game.
Well, but that's the funny thing, is that back in these days, I'm speaking from someone who was going to school in Surrey, so there was a few Man United fans, but even those people who supported other clubs and whatnot, it might not be as partisan. Of course it is with school, it doesn't matter where you are in the country, obviously people still support their teams very, very fervently. But what I'm about to say is, if I'm honest with you, when I went to school the next day, there was an element of Manchester United were representing England.
Yeah.
There wasn't, I think people, especially if you're in the Manchester area and you're a Man City fan, or perhaps if you're in Liverpool or something, you might find that just ridiculous. But genuinely, it was. There was a slight feeling of that, and I think back in those days, before internet, before the Champions League became a much more, you could argue, bloated competition or a much more or a bigger competition, you didn't have it as much on TV. And it was, it was on ITV, it was incredibly exciting. And Manchester United, back in those days, maybe not by then, but certainly around in the 90s, it was just the champions of each league.
Well, English team was Arsenal. We got knocked out in the group stage that year.
Right, so they had changed it by then.
Yeah, do you remember going into this game, the whole comment was, this is the Champions League final between two teams who finished second.
Oh, that's right,
before.
Of course, yeah.
I think that might have been the first time that had happened.
Mm. Yeah, so it was a very different, context, because again, you've usually got four English sides in the Champions League. It football just happens all the time everywhere nowadays. So it was a very, very special thing, and to see an English team in the final of that tournament was the first time I'd witnessed that. You'd have to go back to probably Liverpool, would you, in the 80s, for that kind of thing. So yeah, it was a monumentous occasion, and it had been building. Ferguson had quite a special relationship, if you like, with European football ever since he snuck into Hampden Park as a young boy to watch Real Madrid beat Eintracht Frankfurt 7-3 in the 1965. Yeah. I didn't know that, actually.
Yeah, and also, you say he had a very special relationship with European football, and I think up until this point, the relationship he had with it was that he had obviously had some success elsewhere in the past, but he understood that for him to reach the apotheosis of what he was trying to do with Manchester United, despite all the success they had domestically and despite how dominant they were throughout the 90s, they needed to make an impact on the European Cup, on the Champions League, and he speaks about that a lot in his first autobiography.
Yeah.
And when I refer to his autobiography in this episode today, I'm going to be talking about the first one, which is actually very interesting, with Hugh McIlvenny. I'm not going to be talking about the follow-up one, which is fucking trash.
Which is so, where he slags off all his players and angered Roy Keane.
People need to know the first one is the one to read, and that goes up to, I think, 2000. So it actually culminates in, I think it might even weirdly culminate with Peter Schmeichel leaving after.
Well, this was his last game.
Yeah, exactly. So. I think the idea of destiny, the idea of Ferguson knowing that the standards at that point were so much higher in his opinion, and to be fully taken on board and truly accepted as a great, as a manager, and as Man United being a great team in this era, they had to win the Champions League, and that's why it was so important.
Yeah, Ferguson, I mean, he was obviously a remarkable manager and man, one of the best, for some people would be the best in the history of the game. I think to say the best is not possible.
It's tough, yeah.
So one of the best, and I think if you're in that conversation, you've done very, 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 very well. But he always had such a huge vision. I mean, he won. So the European stuff you perhaps alluded to was when he won the Winners' Cup with Aberdeen, which a great achievement. beating a huge side in the final. So he always had that. And we know that in the late 80s, you know, he brought Manchester United a, sort of a fairly sort of averagey sort of type period in their history and brought them into what we know now as Manchester United, or what we knew then. And he was dominating domestically, but it was about that European thing. And every year they would compete, and then they'd get a little bit further, and they'd come up against Juventus or Borussia Dortmund, and they'd be beaten, and perhaps show a little bit of maybe naivety.
But he would say that. He would say, what the biggest difference between domestic football and European football at the top level is concentration. Yeah. You know, that the players need to learn how to become far more concentrated and far more focused in these big games. I don't know if that came across to you, Vish, as a Man United fan in that era, but like, it felt like there was a bit of a, not a chasm, but a definite gap between Man United knocking teams. They weren't knocking teams over every week at home, because obviously Arsenal had a bit of a say in it, but ultimately they were the dominant team in the Premier League, and there was something inevitable about them at the time, wasn't there?
Yeah, well, it was really, what I found really interesting watching United during that period was how, I don't know, you know, how you do this, but basically, if you took away the opposition and you just had United's patterns of play, you could tell whether they were playing in the league or whether they were playing in Europe.
Good observation.
And there was a level of control in Europe that they assumed, I suppose, where we're just a lot better at retaining the ball, and then we were able to play to the rhythms of the Premier League, which worked well. So obviously, United very good in transitions, and you know, it's one of those things that's quite interesting, because a lot of people talk about this Manchester United way as if like they were the first team to counterattack. They just happened to be better at it than anyone else.
Yeah, yeah.
But they didn't play like that in the Champions League. Mm-hmm. Everything was a lot more intricate. And I think with this particular squad of players, it was perfect by the end of it. I know we're going to talk on, you know, the last game of the season against Spurs, the FA Cup final against Newcastle, and this game against Bayern Munich. Mm-hmm. But I remember even at 13, knowing that we'd had to rotate players and knowing the right matchup of, for example, which of the two, you know, strikers would dovetail well in certain situations, which would, obviously it was an issue for the Champions League final, but like, you know, which midfielders go well together, what Blomqvist does that can make him an adequate substitute for Giggs and stuff like that. And it was so clear because we'd seen it play out over the whole season.
Yeah.
You know, there's a great nugget about, like, if you look at United's best 11 from that squad, they only play together once in the league.
Yeah. And that shows you, again, Ferguson's genius, because squad rotation was not a thing that British football did. In fact, people found it very strange.
They were mistrusting of it.
Why wouldn't you play your best team every week?
Well, exactly. was it Vialli or Ranieri who sort of very overtly did it at Chelsea?
Chelsea were the first team to properly...
But it was named, if you like,
yeah,
at Chelsea. But you're right, Ferguson actually was kind of... Because it was Ferguson, nobody really sort of questioned it. But they had four quality centre-forwards.
But it wasn't just the centre-forwards. We saw it with Nicky Butt. Nicky Butt doesn't make the squad for the FA Cup final.
Yeah.
Because Ferguson, he's played a load of games that season, but he's an important player for them. And if you look what actually transpired, he would have been ideal in that FA Cup final, because Keane went off injured very early on.
Yeah.
And he's not even in the squad because he's saving him for the Champions League final. I mean, that's brave. That's confident management, that.
Ferguson's man management, you can't understate. You know, he would often say to players, I've got you down for 25 games this season, all this kind of stuff, you know, which is mad. And I can't remember who it was, whether it was maybe Nicky Butt.
It was when he said the pitch was too good for you, Nicky.
That's right.
Yeah, you'll come into your own later in the season.
He said, no, FA Cup final's not for you, son.
Yeah.
I've got something better.
Yeah.
And you'd kind of go, he's not playing me in the Cup final, but he's made me feel like there's something better. Now, with that example, of course, there was, because they needed him for the Champions League final, because obviously Scholes and...
It's like when Finn doesn't put me in a ramble react. Yeah. You need me in there. Nah, I'm saving you, son.
Saving you for the preview show. But his man management to keep all these players happy, Sheringham, Solskjaer, Andy Cole and Dwight York.
Yeah.
There's two positions up for grab, because it was a 4-4-2
they
played. God bless it. they And to keep all four of them happy... Cole and Cherry obviously would fall out, but I mean, that's their sort of business. But to keep them all invested in playing and getting tunes out of all of them in specific moments, as of course would be the case in this game, amazing man management. So yes, Manchester United in the Champions League. that season, it was quite incredible, really. I mean, I can remember them in the group phase scoring freely. I mean, in six games, they scored 20 goals. The funny thing is they only won two games in that group.
And Bayern Munich in their group, didn't they?
Bayern Munich and Barcelona. Mm. And those two games were against Bromby.
Poor old Bromby.
Yeah. Who managed to get a win. Yeah. But the games that they played, the 2-3 alls against Barcelona, it was so entertaining.
Yeah.
And you realised that, I think they've cracked it. And then as they go on, of course, they beat Inter 2-0 at home. They do away with them. And then that semi-final against Juventus, the big side, they get through that. And then it's Bayern in the final, a team who they'd played twice before. And it just felt like, for me, this is all geared up for a Manchester United win. And Ferguson was meticulous with his preparation for cup finals. Andy Cole said the mood was almost like the preparation for a third round Milk Cup tie at the third division, some third division.
Yeah, so Ferguson speaks quite eloquently about this. He talks about how he went the extra mile to make sure that everyone that was normally there for a normal, say, home game would be there for this game. So even, say, sometimes, for example, not both the kit men would travel away because they didn't need to.
Yeah.
But in this case, they did. Like, the chef goes out there. I know this sounds pretty straightforward now because they travel with such an entourage these days. But back then, he was basically trying to make it as normal as possible.
Yeah.
Because I think he was so conscious of the idea that a lot of nervous energy is expended in the build-up, and that can be tough, particularly if it's going to be a tough old game and you need to prepare for extra time or whatever. He wanted to make it as normalised as possible for them.
Yeah.
And I think that's obviously a sensible thing to do. Interestingly enough, when I did the Ramble Meets with Jonathan Greening, who was in the squad for this game, didn't come off the bench, but was a young player then, he said that to relax Jonathan Greening, Sir Alex Ferguson offered to play him a game at one frame of snooker in the day or two before they travelled, and said, "If you beat me, I'll put you on the bench," because he knew he had so many injuries.
Yeah.
And Ferguson smashed him apparently and said, "Don't listen, son, I've got a table at home. I've got my own table at home. So don't beat yourself up about it." And then put him on the bench anyway.
I thought you were going to say, "If you beat me, you can make one substitution, not yourself." Obviously, Roy Keane, as we mentioned, was banned for the final because of his yellow card against Juventus. And Ferguson was aware of Roy Keane and the type of character he was. You know, Keane said, "You know, he feels like he hasn't won a Champions League. He's like, I didn't play in the final. You know, whatever." Because Ferguson knew Keane very, very well, he asked Manchester United's head of security, the wonderfully named Ned Kelly, and asked him to keep an eye on Keane and you know, make sure he doesn't do anything too crazy or maybe even disrupt what was going on.
Didn't he just distract him? Him and Scholes and a couple of the family members and a couple of people who weren't ever going to feature. Didn't Ned Kelly just basically take him out on the piss?
Yeah, I don't think he did. I think he had to stay up with him until 4 a.m. drinking.
Right, okay.
Yeah.
Great prep.
Yeah.
But that in itself is brilliant in its own way, isn't it?
Yeah.
Because, you know, having to manage a player outside of your squad, essentially. Yeah. And I don't think that's a slight on Keane, because the way he pulled United through that Juventus semi-final was, the second leg was remarkable, really. Still one of my favourite performances from a United player. But it was fascinating that for all the water that's passed under the bridge in terms of the relationship between Keane and Ferguson, the thing Keane never truly acknowledges, and I suppose it's understandable why he doesn't acknowledge, is how much Ferguson managed him, I suppose, and what he did. And with all due respect to Keane, and absolutely a team player, to be on the cusp of the biggest night in that club, in the club's history at that point, and be able to play no part in it whatsoever, would have been enough, I think, for him to sour quite openly, and therefore you're in a situation there where you're like, right, the guy who was our totem last week is now potentially, like, you know, shaking at the foundations of this thing, you know, ahead of this huge game.
You're right. And Scholes as well, of course, who, not the most upbeat of characters as well. You know, if you've got two of them and the heartbeat of that side, the thing is with that 4-4-2 they played, there's almost like little double acts everywhere.
Yeah,
that system lends itself to that. And those two in the centre of that brilliant midfield with Giggs on the left, Keane Scholes in the centre and Beckham on the right. And they weren't there. Mm. So in the build-up to that game, in 11 days, they win three trophies, 16th of May, They beat Spurs at Old Trafford to win the league by a point. 22nd of May, they beat Newcastle, of course, in the FA Cup final. Interestingly, David May, who did play a bit more for Man United that season, I think people can be a bit harsher on him sometimes, he said to Paul Scholes at half-time in the FA Cup final, "I'm not even tired. I can't believe this is a cup final." Mm. That's how well Ferguson has judged it all.
You've played seven games.
Well.
So, I mean, you made nine appearances in total, the seven starts. So if you're free and tired at that point... you probably should be looking for something else to do.
True enough.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. How's your social battery right now? We're nearly at the end of the Premier League season, so I'm pretty drained. So many tense matches, and some not so tense, as well as point deductions, a battle for the title, and teams on the brink of relegation. All that suspense has me needing a well-deserved break. With the year in full swing, it can be easy to get swept up in work, social engagements, even keeping up with all this football, and we can spread ourselves too thin. But with therapy, you can learn to prioritise your time and really recharge your batteries. It's helpful for learning how to set personal boundaries and empowering you to be the best version of yourself, because you should spend your time on your own terms. So, if you're thinking of starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online, designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. Just fill out a brief questionnaire to get matched with a licensed therapist and switch therapists at any time for no additional charge. Find your social sweet spot with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/ramble today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, BetterHelp.com/ramble. Marcus, Luke and Vish will be back to discuss that 1999 Champions League final. But first, it's time for another bonus edition of Betfair's Popular Bet Builder. Select from the most popular pre-made football bet builders using Betfair's handy app and you can add them to your bet slip in just one tap. We're going to have a crack at the other Champions League semi-final tonight. Manchester City versus Real Madrid. Pick number one, Kevin De Bruyne to assist at any time. He's been Man City's most dependable player on the biggest stages, not least in the first leg. And with Erling Haaland throwing himself at his crosses, there's always a good chance of an assist from Big Kev. Number two, Karim Benzema to score at any time. I mean, he's dependable. He's a monster in the latter stages of the Champions League, so let's go for him. Pick number three, a draw at half-time. The justification being, with the first two picks in mind, it'll probably be neck and neck at half-time. However, pick number four, Manchester City to qualify, including via extra time or penalties. We think that they'll finally shake off the ghost of last season's defeat to Real Madrid and do it. The second leg is at home and the form that Man City are in at the moment is incredible. So that's Kevin De Bruyne to assist at any time, Karim Benzema to score at any time, draw at half time and Manchester City to qualify, including via extra time or penalties. A £5 bet with Betfair on that popular bet builder returns £146.85, and if we win, all that money will go to Prostate Cancer UK, exclusive to Betfair Sportsbook. T's and C's apply. 18 plus only. For more information on responsible gambling, get yourself to begambleaware.org.
So, yes, we get to the 26th of May, and Manchester United, it was their 63rd game of the season. Mm. 63rd. And, of course, they had their injuries. I know Bayern were missing one or two players, but it was a slightly makeshift side. You know, Beckham came into the centre of midfield. He had played centre midfield before. But
yeah, Ferguson said that Beckham would constantly say that centre midfield was his favourite position.
Yeah. So I don't think that was a huge thing. But, of course, in that side, the way he would whip the ball in and so on, that was where he played. Giggs was on the right side. It was a little bit disjointed. And you could see that when you played, because back in those days, of course, an inverted winger was just, we don't do that. How on earth is he going to cross the ball with his other foot if he's on the right side
but
to the left
it
side?
It kind of makes more sense than you'd think. It's a bit of a no-brainer to play Giggs on the right for a couple of reasons. One, because it means you can play Blomqvist, who's a more attacking player, but also because Bayern Munich were without Bescente Lizarazu.
Yeah.
And Michael Tarnat wasn't as good a player as him, and he wasn't as quick either.
No.
So it actually is a perfect matchup, really, because Giggs can also cut in and do all the stuff he normally does, because Giggs is really a generationally good player.
It was all set up for Manchester United victory, and then, of course, they go behind after 6 minutes when Mario Basler scores the free kick.
I can't believe you've jumped over the most entertaining thing of the whole game.
Go on.
Montserrat Cabal doing Barcelona in the opening ceremony.
Oh, true enough.
Little tribute to Freddie.
Yeah.
Come on.
All right, forgive me.
You've got to acknowledge that.
Forgive me.
It's okay.
Thank you. All right. Accept my apology, damn you. So yes, that was great. So again, but I think that's the thing, is that Barcelona, it's just this wonderful city, and again, that
such
stadium,
a beautiful horizon, you may say.
I would say. I would very much follow in the footsteps of those who have said that before. And after 6 minutes, Bayern score. And it did feel like, oh, that's not the script, despite Manchester United often coming back.
Yeah.
And then I remember Tilsley on commentary going, oh, deflected and in. Because you thought, well, the mighty Peter Schmeichel was not going to be beaten like that, but it wasn't deflected.
No.
It was a sucker punch, which nearly won the game.
I think even now I watch it, and I have felt this when I watched it at the time, I was really confused, but partly because of the camera angle, that Schmeichel seems like he's in the middle of the wall when they take one shot from behind.
Yeah. Gary Neville said that Ferguson's team shape didn't work well, and I think that's fair to say, because after that goal, Manchester United... They just didn't look the same.
My take on this is slightly different to your guys, I think.
Yeah.
I think that people have a tendency to backfill the narrative, and people think that, you know, Bayern Munich sucker punched United early, which I think I agree with that, and then United kind of counterpunched them in the last minute and sucker punched them back, and it's kind of, that's what the game's known for. That's the narrative.
Yeah.
I actually thought that the game was pretty even. Like, I remember at the time thinking it was quite even. I watched it back and thought the same. And I thought one thing that I actually came away from watching it again was quite a kind of obvious lack of ambition from Bayern Munich, in a way that... Now, I know they hit the crossbar, I think, twice.
Yeah.
But that's when you're not going to really push.
Post and bar.
That's right. And that's when you're not going to really push in. So I don't mean that, because I think we see that happen in most knockout games.
Those were both United. So the Yanker one off the bar.
Oh, yeah.
I think United have like three or four opportunities to clear that, and are just in panic mode because they just need to get up the other
exactly.
end.
Exactly. So I wouldn't say that's indicative. And what I would say is that, in a weird way, scoring so early kind of hurt Bayern Munich as well, because they're a really good team. They had really good players. And if you look at the central midfield issue that you've mentioned with Keane and Scholes, I don't think you can sit there and say Effenberg had a good game.
No,
I don't think he didn't really stamp his authority on it.
That is interesting. I've never looked at it from their point of view, to be honest with you. But when you say that, there's an element of, dare I say it, like England in that, isn't there?
I think so.
Maybe we scored a bit earlier.
I actually think it's really interesting if you look at Franz Beckenbauer's comments, who is, I think, is the president of Bayern Munich then, and he says that, I can't exactly remember the exact quote, but he says he was disappointed with how Bayern Munich approached it and how they didn't kind of force their force their superiority home with the goal ahead.
Yeah, I mean it's difficult. As a Vish says, I didn't really think about it like that. But it was a classic final in that the two semi-finals, you know. Manchester United win 3-2 in Turin, you know, very entertaining game. Bayern Munich drew 3-3 in Kyiv with Dynamo Kyiv, that wonderful side with Shevchenko and Rebrov up front. Mm. You know, very entertaining. You get to the final having seen a few goals in the semi-final, and then it's like, oh, everyone seizes up and let's just get over the line. So you're right to say they scored early. But I actually, watching the game, but I mean, it was a long time ago, I remember thinking, Manchester United can't get through. And if you're a Bayern Munich player...
They were quite disjointed, weren't they?
Yeah, I think if you're a Bayern Munich player, it would be disappointing to not go and press home that advantage. But you also might think, well, actually, we're keeping them at arm's length. Manchester United hardly created anything of note, really. And even after Ferguson's halftime team talk, they didn't cut. In the second half, you thought, right, where's the reaction? I mean, Ferguson said at halftime, if you lose, you'll be 6 feet away from the European Cup, but you won't be able to touch it. And I want you to think about that fact, that you'll have been so close to it. And for many of you, it will be the closest you ever get. And you will hate that thought for the rest of your lives. You hear those words. But again, in the second half, it didn't really prompt sort of huge reaction.
I think that feeds into what I'm saying, because I'll tell you why. Because Bayern Munich made it really tough for United, and that was like their MO. Yeah,
so there you go. So they nearly got over the line.
But how often have you seen amazing, great teams come up against a really solid team and not be able to, not be able to create chances in the way they normally do because there's no space? Like Bayern Munich didn't attack at all through Effenberg, who was a really dynamic midfield player. They didn't have Lizarazu.
Yeah, but they didn't have Elbear up front as well, who's one of their big goal scorers. So they're 1-0 up and they're looking very, very comfortable.
But was Elbear a real creator of his own chances, or was he a goal scorer?
Well, not necessarily, but if you're one of your key players is not up top, you're 1-0 up, they're creating nothing. Of course there's a temptation to go, lads, let's sit in here because if we commit, and then they have a chance off the post and they think, the back door is left open. I understand from a Bayern Munich point of view it's disappointing, but I don't think that I would say, they were piss poor in this final. I think that
I'm not saying they were. I'm just saying they didn't show any ambition. And I think I personally believe we'll never know. Look, we'll never know. And maybe it would be different if Lizarazu was there because he was a prototype kind of attacking fullback, right? Who had an amazing career and he wasn't there. But I think if United have Keane and Scholes in there, they'll walk this game.
But you can't say that.
It's my opinion.
Yeah, but Bayern then set up differently. It's a whole different feeling. It's very, very difficult to start saying that.
Well, the thing you talk about, I suppose it's more Luke's point about a lack of ambition from Bayern Munich, was the last 15 minutes.
Yeah.
And, let's forget about the goals. Let's talk about, from 75 minutes onwards, when Bayern Munich make those changes, taking off their wide men, bringing on Mehmet Scholl and Salihamidzic to go narrower. And so Ferguson
Salihamidzic comes on much later. They bring on Thorsten Fink before him. And Mehmet
Plugging up the middle, aren't they?
Yeah, sure.
They've seen Giggs is not doing much. They don't have Beckham's crossing ability. I remember once Beckham actually tries to go out wide and cross one in. He's like trying to do what he wants, but he's not having it. And they pick up on that.
So Ferguson had noted that that's how Bayern Munich see out games.
Yeah.
And so when he decides to go through up top there, when he takes Cole off for Solskjaer, brings on Sheringham.
Sheringham first.
Leaves York up there as well.
Yeah.
The reason he does that is because they do what he thinks they're going to do.
Yeah.
And therefore he's like, right, we'll just chuck another striker up there.
Sure. Well, the reaction of those Bayern fans, the way they were celebrating and the chance and so on. I mean, Sheringham said, didn't he? He was sat on the bench and he was fuming, looking at them, going, he was like, put me on, get me. Yeah. And Solskjaer said that he was angry that Sheringham got on first. The fire in their guts to get out
and make
a difference.
The other thing around the strikers issue and towards the end of the game is that Ferguson also says he sees how nervous Dwight York is on the day of the final and he almost doesn't play him.
Yeah, that's fascinating.
He's not sure if he can handle the situation. He also says that Kafur and Linker were much better than they thought they would be at keeping York and Cole quiet, and partly that was because York was nervous and didn't really handle the game that well, which is, again, this is why Ferguson's first book's so good, because he just fucking got the whole back.
Yeah.
And then if you go to the first goal, the equalising goal, which was, it was really interesting goal to witness in the aftermath of it, because you can see Steve McLaren trying to get Ferguson to make all these changes they'd obviously worked on.
Yeah.
And Ferguson's refusing to do it. And the reason he said he refuses to do it is because he said the biggest indicator for him of why he was so confident Man United were going to go on to win is because he said he had never seen a set of players in all his years of management, in terms of the Bayern players, react to an equaliser like that. He said that he felt like that he looked like that. He said the quote he uses is, they all looked like they were staggering away from a plane crash.
Yeah.
He said there was no way that they could come back from that.
That's right.
It was almost like criminal how badly they dealt with it.
Yeah.
And he said he knew after that. But it's obviously he's writing after the event, so it's easy to go back.
Yeah, but even in the moment, though, McLaren tells him to go back for a 4-4-2 and
prepare for extra time.
And
basically,
Ferguson tells him to sit down.
Yeah, that's it. Yeah, because he wants to prepare for extra time because that's his job. He's like the coach.
Well, indeed,
we should say as well, McLaren's absolutely doing his job there.
Yeah.
So well and good to like say nothing, but in that moment to be like, look, I think we should do this.
But that goes into the point about Bayern Munich being so overconfident. you bring on the players. Ah, yeah, we see this out. And again, you can't stress enough. I remember watching on the TV, those Bayern fans are creating an atmosphere of we're two or three up. And it's the last minute of injury time and we're already celebrating. Yeah. You know when you see the players sometimes like, oh, I just want to go on the pitch and grab the trophy. That was what the vibe was like. Lothar Matthäus goes off, one of their big players at the time, and blah, 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 blah. And yeah.
So Schmeichel goes up for the corner in the 91st minute. It causes a bit of chaos. It falls to Giggs. Crucially, on Giggs' right foot.
Yes.
Yeah. His shot is poor because it's like a little snapshot with his right foot. And Sheringham's there to nudge it in, basically.
And it looked offside.
It
even looks round, doesn't he? Yeah. And Sheringham scored a very late one against Juventus in that semi-final tie, which was a crucial one. And he scored some crucial goals. You know, he scored in the FA Cup final.
Didn't score a lot of goals that season, but that wasn't strictly what he was there for.
Indeed.
Yeah.
But when Sheringham was a great impact sub for England and for club as well. He was a marvellous player to bring on. And he scores. And it was just like, oh my goodness. And of course, the commentary before that, Clive Tyldesley, surely Manchester United will score. They always score.
Exactly.
And Rob Smythe did the maths for this. Manchester United played 2,580 minutes of football across 28 games from that Liverpool turnaround in the third round of the FA Cup.
Yeah.
If you remember, they were 1-0 down and they put and scored a couple of late goals. So from then, right, 2,580 minutes of football, for only 318 minutes did they have a cushion of more than one goal.
Yeah.
The jeopardy in all those
games.
Yeah,
they won all that stuff.
Absolutely incredible.
It's a different kind of dominance. It's almost like a psychological dominance rather than a kind of goal scoring.
Well, they go
dominance.
1-0 down to Spurs on the final day of the season.
Yeah.
Now, I know Spurs, obviously Arsenal going for the league and Spurs aren't playing for much, but you've still got to bring it round. You can't show any nervousness. Mm. And then, of course, so they score the goal and it's kind of like lift off. Here we go. We're back. There they are. I think that was it. There they are, is what I thought. And then, of course, up the other end, I can't remember off the top of my head now, my mind's going crazy. They get another corner and you sort of think, nah, really?
Yeah.
But there was that kind of, oh, hello, Beckham's delivery and Solskjaer has won it. Mm.
Yeah.
It is one of the most incredible moments I've ever seen watching football.
Yeah.
Because again, the age I am, the context of all that sort of stuff, and it goes in.
Well, and it feeds back into the whole...
Still gets me now, that.
It still feeds back into the whole Ferguson take on the Bayern Munich reaction.
Mm.
Because Man United win a corner like 25 seconds after Bayern Munich have kicked off.
Yeah.
There's absolutely no reason.
Yeah,
what
yeah.
Bayern Munich should have been...
Keep the damn thing.
It's easy for me to say, and you know, it's emotions and all the rest of it. But there's no real excuse for that, whatever the circumstance. If you're a professional team playing at that level in a big final, you should be able to stop something like that happening. Even if you have to lump it and hold it up for 20 seconds, but just calm down, relax, all that kind of stuff. And 25 seconds is an incredibly short amount of time for a team in that environment, in that situation, to be winning another corner.
Yeah.
It was the first time in that match where it looked like Manchester United were going downhill.
Mm.
And it was the very end of the game.
And it was a set, but it was a scrappy one. But the football they'd played up until the final, again, was just amazing to watch. And they dug themselves out of the hole in Turin when they went 2-0 down early. Yeah. And I think when they did that, myself included, thought that was the real trial and test that they came through.
Well, I also think
of course it wouldn't be
that beyond conceding an equaliser that late in a game of that importance, knowing that your opponent is of a certain standard anyway, I think by then Manchester United had created a reputation for themselves in Europe that, right, this is a proper team here.
Yeah.
And for someone like Bayern Munich to be, shit.
Yeah.
Oh, it's them. Oh, well, they are here.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. But it obviously got in their head. I mean, again, I think that goes into how Bayern sort of played the game.
Ferguson also said for the first time in his career, he spent a few minutes preparing himself to be a gracious loser in defeat and all the media commitments he'd have to do. And he said beforehand, because I think as it meant so much to him, I think beforehand he would never do that because it was like, you know, Man United have never done till they're done.
Yeah.
And he said here, he was like, he couldn't help himself. He kept stopping himself, preparing what he was going to say afterwards.
Yeah.
Which obviously isn't ideal because you're supposed to be concentrating on the game and how you can affect it.
Mm.
But it wasn't, Marcus, you're absolutely right. It was an incredible moment. It's a moment that's kind of knitted into the very fabric of English football. It's kind of hard to imagine football in this country without it.
Yeah.
The same way, like, you know, don't get too high-minded about it, but you know, the ocean's always there, right? It's always there. Like, so someone says to you, what's it like, if there's no mountains in the world, you thought that'd be fucking weird.
Yeah.
It's like this in football. Yeah. Like this is knitted into the, as I say, knitted into the very fabric of what English football is.
And Manchester United as well.
And absolutely Manchester United, who were, whether we like it or not, and I don't really have a take on this, but in the 90s, Man United were the ambassador of English football in Europe.
That's what I mean.
Europe. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, if Ferguson would like to say Europe had become a personal crusade, I knew I would never be judged a great manager until I won the European Cup, which is what you were touching on much earlier. And it's true. And I think for him, like that interview when after the game, oh, football, bloody hell.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, even that. Yeah. Like, that's iconic.
It is iconic. And again, for Ferguson, who was always in control of his thought. I mean, not that he's out of control saying that, but you can see the occasion and the victory got to him. Mm. Whereas he would enjoy victories, but you could see that in his mind, yeah, this is great. I'm really enjoying this. And he's just thinking, right, what's next?
Yeah.
How are we going to do this next? Whereas this, I felt that he was just like, no, we're off out tonight. Do you know what I mean?
he says in his book, he says that the celebrations of that win will, for everyone that was there, will never really end.
Yeah.
That's a beautiful thing to say.
So, 99, I was 13, adored Manchester United, mm-hmm. and that was that interview with ITV, having seen him smile and cheer and lift trophies before that, that was the first time I ever looked at him and I knew he was happy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's right.
Because, you know, he always talks about, you know, when you win the league, it's always about the next one, this, that, and the other. And, you know, unless you're Real Madrid, the current iteration of Real Madrid, it's not a thing of thinking about how do we defend this next year.
No.
To most normal teams.
It's the apex.
Yeah, it is the apex. And to see him get there was like, okay, good. But he is happy.
Yeah. Do you think, though, that quote about the celebrations never ending? Because, again, the way they built in the 90s throughout the European Cup and Champions League, and they get better and further and further, and then boom, they do it. Manchester United would only win one knockout game in the next seven seasons.
Yeah. But that happens, though, doesn't it?
In this trophy.
I think, like, I understand the nature of this sport, and certainly the nature of what we do in this sport is about essentially level towards performance. A lot of the things we talk about, a lot of the people we talk about, it's based on performance.
Yeah.
But sometimes there comes a point where you get to the top, and the reason it's so hard to get to the top is because there's so little space. Very few teams throughout history bed in there. And it's, you know, that is quite jarring. But at the same time, I kind of understand why it took a while for a new group of players to win it, you know,
and also
almost 10 years later.
The teams you're playing against, I mean, they got knocked out in the first knockout round by Real Madrid the following season, Bayern Munich the season after that. And they came out up against Leverkusen the year after that and only lost very narrowly to them, who then themselves, they lost in away goals, I think, and then themselves only just lost to Real Madrid in the final. So, you know, it's fine margins at that level. But that's the thing, isn't it? When you talk about, Ferguson will talk about how he regrets that he only won two Champions Leagues with Man United in 1999-2008, and he would like to have won more. But then you're almost thinking, well,
I think
that comes from more being in finals, though, doesn't it?
Trouble is, two of the finals you played were Guardiola's Barcelona.
Yeah,
that's the point, though.
Yeah,
that's
my
point. You're coming up against Real Madrid.
Yeah,
you're coming up against Guardiola's Barcelona. You're coming up against all these amazing teams. That's the whole point of
but
the competition.
I think just the fact that how many times they were in the competition. I think he's probably looking at the ratio, but I think that's a touch harsh. You know, he's won two for crying out loud. But again, if you think about it, it was only until relatively recently that a team defended the Champions League for the first time, which was, of course, Real Madrid, when they won three in a row under Zinedine Zidane.
Plucky old Real Madrid.
But it's, you know, it's such a hard competition to win, you know?
And I think if you want to sum up the drama of it for people listening who weren't old enough to remember it or whatever, there's a story, isn't there, possibly apocryphal, of the great George Best.
That's right.
Who's there as a guest of honour in the 99 final, wins it with Man United in 1968, which is, of course, the last time they'd won it. I think even the only time they'd won it. And he's there as a guest of honour, and he's George Best, right? So he gets mobbed wherever he goes, El Beato, all the rest of it. He leaves. He doesn't actually find out Man United have won it, I think, until he gets to the airport and word passes around that... where are you going? He's like, I'm going home. Well, no, fucking stay.
Yeah,
well, stay. You see, that's how late it was. You talk about two goals in injury time. That's in the biggest game in club football of the season.
Yeah.
For two goals to happen in about 90 seconds to win the trophy. Yeah, yeah, yeah. That's how late and how dramatic it was.
Yep.
Best had gone. He didn't even know.
Well, you see, I've heard a different version. And this is how this...
How's Bob's health?
This is. This is the version that I heard, because Best was...
You heard that he scored the winner.
I did. Best is he's on his way out of the stadium because he's probably sat up in the posh seats. Hmm. So he's making his way down and something. Oh, no, they've scored. Right. Really? You better get back up there. By the time he's back up there, they've already won it.
Huh.
So that's okay. What I'd heard.
Well, that's funny because...
You got a third version.
There is a third version of that. And I think it is true, but it's the... Whoever presented United with the trophy was on the way down to prepare to do so for Bayern Munich.
So that's
they'd equalised, came back up, and United had won it.
There you go. So that's probably what I'm thinking.
It's all part of the myth.
Yeah.
It's all part of the great entertainment.
My best mate was at the game, also a United fan, and by the time the celebrations had stopped for United's equaliser,
they were up again.
They already scored.
I've heard that.
He said he was so confused that. The delirium just passed around that they just had no idea what happened. And he looked out onto the field and there weren't any players there. No one was standing. All the United, where he was sat, all the United players were away into one corner.
Yeah.
All the Bayern Munich players were
on the
flat
floor.
On the floor. And he was like, where the fuck has everyone gone?
Yeah.
He was like, genuinely, it was like a spaceship came over and sucked everyone up and moved on.
There's that iconic slow motion footage of Sami Kaufur banging the ground.
Oh, that was hard to see.
And I watched it again preparing for this, and it's so hard watching someone go through that.
Yeah.
Even though, like, you know, your team, you know, somebody's support has been responsible for that, but just the anguish and anger. Wow.
Yeah, indeed.
Incredible night. It lived long in the memory, never be forgotten. Certainly not by Man United fans. It shouldn't really be forgotten for any fan of football because it's such a huge moment, such a pivotal moment in and these things are the things that burnish the reputation and the success of the Champions League. Sometimes that's forgotten. I think, you know, the thing that makes a Champions League, for example, so successful, and perhaps even all the problems that come along with it, its dominance and its precedence and all the rest of it, they're built on moments like this.
That's right.
You know, the same way the Premier League is built on Gascoigne's tears, as they say, you know, when people start to realise, actually, fucking hell, there's a lot of money to be made in this fucking game.
Yeah.
It's the same with this. It's something that, as I said, stitches into the fabric of a truly glorious competition that can only be a glorious competition because of these moments all put together.
Absolutely right. Absolutely right, everybody. Well, there we are. Thank you very much. Thank you very much for joining us on another Football Ramble Guide 2. Remember, we want your ideas for what our next guide should be. Email us, show@footballramble.com, or tweet us @footballramble. With your suggestions, eh?
We should do more of these. These are fun.
Yeah. Do you want to do Man United in their two finals against Barcelona?
No. We don't. I know we mentioned before. We don't have to do Solskjaer's time at United either.
That's a good idea.
Fine.
If you could put that in an email.
Who do you think emailed in this one?
Football Ramble Guide 2s, eh? Bloody hell. There we are. See you for the next one.
The Football Ramble is a Stack production and part of the Acast Creator Network.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Before Shopify, were you wondering, where are my sales at? Now you're selling with Shopify, the global commerce platform supercharging your selling. You have no problem selling online, in person, on social media, and beyond. Gary, easy on the cha-ching.
Oh, sorry, but my Shopify sales are through the roof.
Start selling with Shopify today and discover how millions of businesses around the world use Shopify to ignite their selling. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/listen. Shopify.com/listen.
I'm Kate Thornton. Join me every week on White Wine Question Time, the podcast that asks famous faces three thought-provoking questions over three glasses of wine.
It's very rare to be introduced with such a thorough introduction, and it's kind of lovely to listen to all that and go, yeah, I've had a good life, right?
You really have.
How did you find that?
I can't even remember. Yeah, you do your research, Kate, man. I'll tell you that.
Do you know what? You are the only person ever, no other journalist has ever made that connection.
Wow, what a great question.
And receives some truly memorable answers.
And Tom Cruise came and Nicole Kidman. I go to him, listen, before you go, Tom, I just want you to know, if you fancy a foursome, I'm up for it, and I know Anne-Marie doesn't mind.
When I first dated my now husband, I joined a gym for, I'm going to say, £1,000 a year, just so I could go off and have a poo.
Actually, I got heckled once in Wales, and there was a bloke at the bar on crutches, and he actually said to me, I'd rather fall over than listen to this shit, and he threw his crutches at me and fell over. Can you believe that?
I've got some cat's ashes, I don't know who they are.
You've been catfished by your own cat.
Exactly, seriously, man.
Dad, have you thought about putting in a breakfast nook? And my dad was thinking like that. Have you thought about getting your own fucking house?
How did you give a duck an orgasm, Craig?
It's good with them, you know. And then we're way around a duck.
So, if you fancy a sit-down with the likes of Adam Hills, Tom Allen, Hannah Waddingham, Phil Tufnell, James Acaster and Ed Gamble, Daisy May Cooper, and tons more, then join me every Tuesday and Friday. Search White Wine Question Time in your podcast app to subscribe and listen now. White Wine Question Time is a Stack production.